You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Daniel Freeburn, and I'm here to guide you through today's departure from the usual programming in this long, you may also say tedious, intermezzo between the 2025 and 2026 cycling seasons. A departure because today we've got something slightly different for you. A few weeks ago, the most intriguing subplot of the 2025 campaign, then drawing to its conclusion, was the fight for survival in cycling's top division, the World Tour, at the end of the three-year 2023 to 2025 promotion and relegation cycle. Most of you will remember the outcome, subject to Lotto and Intermarché's long-mooted merger finally going through, and with Arkea shutting up shop, Cofidis ultimately lost their World Tour status to Uno X Mobility. Over the three counting seasons, the French team had scored 25,926 points to the Scandinavians' 26,324. The three-year game of snakes and ladders has many critics, but there can be no disputing that this time, at least, it was a compelling watch in those last weeks of the autumn. We certainly thought it merited further investigation, which is why this week's episode will be the first in a series of specials, each going behind the scenes of one of the imperiled team's battles to retain their World Tour status. The plan is for the first two installments to go out as regular episodes and the others to be published in the next couple of weeks as Kilometre Zero Friends specials. Just a reminder that by signing up as a friend of the Cycling Podcast, you're facilitating our annual on-the-ground coverage of races like the Grand Tours. You can become a friend for as little as £35 a year by going to thecyclingpodcast.com and clicking on the Become a Friend link. In a way, we're starting our mini-series with the most fascinating, certainly surprising story of all, XDS Astana's astonishing rise out of the relegation zone. The Kazakh outfit, of course, has a long, sometimes illustrious, often controversial history in the sport, but at the start of the season, they were also facing the doomsday scenario of demotion. They languished in 21st in the three-year rankings, over 5,000 points behind Cofidis and nearly 2,000 adrift of Uno X. To put that into perspective, over the whole of 2024 as a team, they had racked up only 6,578 points. Their best placed rider on the individual UCI rankings in that season was Lorenzo Fortunato in 154th position. How had their predicament become so dire? I, like most people who followed the sport, and particularly those who cover races on the ground, had observed a slow decline, a loss of momentum and also identity over several years. This was also the reality described by insiders. In the first season of the triennium, it was certainly the picture painted by a rider on the team who, as it turned out, was on his way out of professional cycling just as he disembarked what seemed then like a sinking Astana ship. I'm talking about the American Joe Dombrowski. Earlier this week, I invited Joe to remember that experience.
Let's say the morale in the team, the ambiance, was probably not the best. It's a little bit chicken or egg, you know, is that because of the results not really being there, or are the results not there because of the, you know, the culture or the morale? Some of the issues started actually in 2021. If we kind of wind back the clock, there was a period where Vinokourov was thrown out of the team management. I was under contract with UAE at that time, but had been talking with Astana, and you know, then when that happened, basically everything froze, and they didn't really get around to signing riders until quite late. So I signed at the end of the Vuelta. My impression was very much that with the departure of Vino for a little while, they lost a lot of their top guys to other teams who weren't sure, you know, what was going to happen going forward. And then it was kind of this hodgepodge of riders coming in without, I would say, a really clear objective for like what you're building a team around. You know, I particularly remember like I was one of, I think, four riders from UAE who weren't kept by UAE, and, you know, Astana signed all of us. It felt like maybe the team had lost its way a little bit. Vincenzo Nibali with his last Giro, there was a little bit of a rally around that, but there were large chunks of the calendar where you would go to a race and it wasn't really clear, like, is there a leader? Is there someone we're working for? Like, what is the objective? Is it just like, you know, go in the breakaway and, you know, maybe the breakaway will stay away and you can contest for a stage win because we don't have anyone that can do GC. We don't have a sprinter. And then going into 2023 with Cav being available on the market and, you know, the whole history of trying to get the Tour de France stage win record, that became very much the focus for the 2023 season. So I would say that that was kind of another rallying point for the team. But, you know, Cav's only one rider and it was really focused on one race. And another thing is, and I'm not saying this is a critique per se, but I think something that has changed is, you know, before the Astana, they had to have 10 Kazakh riders. And realistically, they couldn't use all these guys consistently in big races. So you were often operating on more of like a 23-man roster than a 30-man roster.
Explicitly, was the can you remember in 2023 any talk about points and the necessity to get points, bearing in mind that they just ended the previous three-year cycle in 13th place? So safe, comfortably safe, but you know, sliding.
Basically, the discussion around points in 2022, they during the season, it was talked about, but I think they had sort of calculated, barring any, you know, anything extraordinary, that they were going to be safe for the end of that 2022 cycle. So there wasn't a lot of stress about it. I remember doing Nibali's last Giro with him in 2022, and the team, Alexander Schaefer, the head director, was pretty clear about, you know, little things like, okay, when, you know, when you're dropped or your job is done for the day, like just ride in as easy as possible. Not this thinking about like, well, if, you know, if we have this guy that finishes 8th or 12th or whatever on the stage, like that's a few more points here and there. Whereas I think that shifted in 2023, where there was more discussion about it. Granted, it was only the first year of the cycle, so that stress hasn't really built, but I think they had seen the kind of downward slide of the team. And if you sort of projected that, you know, continued downward slide going forward, it's like, if we keep going like this, we're not going to be a World Tour team anymore. And you could see that was at the back of their mind.
So as that season sort of winds down, unfortunately, it ended up being your last Grand Tour. But the Vuelta, looking from the outside, it seemed to me that the team's morale was pretty much in its boots. I don't know what happened on stage three, but I have a memory of you sort of gingerly getting off the bus in Andorra at the start of stage four. And I had the strong impression that there'd been a bit of a dressing down, not of you personally, but of the
team in general. Yes. Yeah. The morale was pretty low. It's almost like a vicious cycle where lack of performance leads to more lack of performance just to the, you know, and I remember like some of the meetings on the bus, head director and management were pretty dissatisfied for how it was going. But that was, I think, a trend even the 2 years I was there. I remember, for example, 2022 in the Tour de France, there was one day like we just had no meeting on the bus because the directors were so kind of pissed about how the race was going. They were like, you know, you guys aren't deserving of a race meeting. So, you know, that was that. For example, when you have a breakaway of 15 riders and there's no one from Astana in it, it means that in theory, if each team has one rider, like almost every team's there and you're not. And in a lot of cases, you know, a day like that, it becomes pretty clear pretty early on from the peloton, but also the director's car, that like no one's going to pull and you've essentially wasted the day. Like you don't even have a single card to play. So at that point, you have a bunch of riders, professional riders you're paying to just like ride around in the bunch and, you know, do nothing. You know, I do remember in some team meetings that was definitely expressed to us that the results were not satisfactory.
It would be wrong to say that it was an inexorable fall. In some ways, 2024 was a huge success, at least in one way. Midway through that year, Mark Cavendish took his 35th Tour de France stage win, making history. But in the cold light of the morning after, oblivion in the form of relegation still beckoned. At the start of 2024, Cavendish's coach from his last stint at Quickstep, Vasilis Anastopoulos, had joined Astana as the head of performance. With Project 35 ticked off, it now fell to him, in large part, to draw up the roadmap to another miracle. You're about to hear him describe that process, how and why it exceeded. The bare numbers when the count stopped were certainly quite astonishing. Astana would finish the season in 15th place on the all-important three-year ranking and 4th for just 2025. Their points total of 16,716, comfortably exceeding the combined harvest of the previous 2 years. To add further context, 13 riders had surpassed the biggest haul of any Astana rider in 2024, Lorenzo Fortunato's 652 points. As we said, a modern-day cycling miracle, at least on a par with Cavendish's in 2024. That too, masterminded by Vasilis Anastopoulos. Well, Vasi, you and I know each other a little bit. We've got to know each other over the last couple of years. But for those who don't, tell us a little bit about how you came into cycling. Because a Greek bike rider, or coach, or head of performance, as you've become, is a bit of an oddity in professional cycling. So tell us about the man behind, I think some of your charges have christened you the Greek god of, I don't know, training peaks, but how did you get into cycling?
Yeah, that's a bizarre story, to be honest. So first of all, I was the first Greek professional rider back in 2000. So I rode for it.
The very first.
Yeah, see that. Till then, we didn't know. In Greece, we didn't know what professional cycling means. Apart from the start of the Giro d'Italia in 1996, when you had the opportunity to watch all the pro riders back then. But apart from that...
Which you've told me about. You were one of about three people who turned up to watch it.
Maybe four, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And yeah. Some Japanese tourists back then. Yeah, exactly. So apart from that, we had no idea about professional cycling. So in 2000, I joined Vorarlberg, a team, a GS3 team then in Austria, which became Volksbank as a GS2 team, Pro Tour team now, in 2005-2006. When I finished I spent most of my career there in Austria, living for 6 years over there. Then I came back to Greece. I finished my studies at the sport science at the University of Athens. I became national coach for the Greek team. And then 2011, I joined the UCI coaching course in Egle, where I spent 2 months doing the course. And over there, I had the opportunity of meeting one of the biggest now managers, cycling managers in the world, Martijn Berghout, who runs SEG cycling together with his brother Eiko. So we spent 2 months in a small apartment together, chatting about cycling and everything. And then he told me, I can see that you have a lot of knowledge, even though you are coming from a non-cycling country. So if I ever want to start a team, you'll be the first time that I'm going to call. So from then on, I just continued working for the national team here in Greece. And I also was running a Conti team in Greece, SP Everywhere, as a coach and as a manager. So back then I had to do everything. And then Martin asked me to start training Thomas Dekker after his suspension back from doping. So I started training Thomas Dekker and then Johan van Sommeren. And then in 2025, we start together SEG Racing Academy, where I stayed there till 2019. I had the privilege of working with some of the really big talents who dominate now the World Tour. So in total, we had, I think, 36 riders going to the pros from this project. In 2019, I joined Quickstep. I stayed there for 4 years as a coach. And since 2024, performance manager of head of performance at the Exes Astana.
And of course at Quickstep, or we know it generally as Quickstep, that was where you got to know Mark Cavendish, and you were very instrumental in him equaling the Tour de France stage win record in 2021. But then Mark left the team at the end of 2020 2002, he went to Astana, but you didn't go with him straight away because you entered the picture at the start of 2024. And well, we're going to talk in a moment about where the team sat at the start of 2024. But I've got that right, haven't I? You didn't immediately go with Mark to Astana at the start of 2023.
Yes, exactly. I still had a contract with Quickstep. So after Mark left Astana, I stayed with Quickstep for one more year. And then during that year, Mark asked me to join Astana. The first idea was to join Astana as the head of performance. Back then, we thought that Mark should would stop and he would take a role in the management. So he asked me to join him in Astana and help the team grow up. Of course, we all know the story with the crash and you know, his decision to continue. So by the time that he decided to continue, I had already agreed with Vinokurov to join Astana. So it was just a coincidence. We can say that I joined the team, Mark continued, agreed to continue, and then we just worked together till, you know, 35th win. So worked together for the 35 project.
Okay. So, Vasi, at the end of 2023, when you join, effectively, the team has finished the first year of the promotion relegation cycle, and they're 21st in the ranking. They've scored 7,046 points that year. Highest, I mean, Lutsenko had a good year. He was the highest point scorer, 1,485. Velasco, 900. And Mark himself, because of course he had won races that year. He won in the Giro, for example. He had 856 points. But as I say, 21st in the rankings. Now, nonetheless, Vasi, my impression is that you're the main sort of focus for the team in 2024, maybe the main thing on your agenda was still Mark's record at the Tour de France and not UCI points. Now, tell me if I'm wrong and tell me what sort of space did UCI points, promotion relegation, what space did that sort of occupy on your list of priorities as head of performance?
Yeah. So first of all, 2023, the end of 2023 was my first year on the team. So I had to get to know everybody. I didn't know anyone. I didn't know the riders. I didn't know the staff. So I had no idea about this team. So it took me some months to get to know what is, you know, what's the dynamics of the team, what is the strength and limiters of the riders and everything. We had a lot of Kazakh riders that year, which meant that the dynamic of the team, the strength of the team was not really high compared to the other World Tour teams. So the first thing that I did joining the team was to reduce the race days because I could feel that we didn't have the human resources to do the whole calendar as it used to be. Secondly, of course, my focus was mostly on the Project 35. That was the main goal of the season. So once the season got going, it was obvious that we couldn't win races. We're mostly focusing on Mark. The riders who were in Mark's train and Mark's group just sacrificed their own chances by the races to help Mark win as much as possible. So once we achieved the goal, I got a message from Vinokurov, I think after 2-3 days, told me, okay, now we achieved the goal, but we're in a really big trouble because we need to do something next year, otherwise we're going to be relegated. So immediately after the Tour de France, I started working with my data engineer, a guy that helped me a lot during the 35 project.
So this is a guy, it's a French guy called Morgan Saucine, I think his name is, isn't it? Now, tell us about him and the relationship. How did you get to know him? He was also involved in Project 35, but tell us everything about this relationship because he becomes a kind of key figure.
Yeah, that's true. I think early November, I got a message on LinkedIn about a French guy who introduced me.
So early November 2023?
Yes. So he introduced me himself and told me I'm a data engineer. I can probably help you with some calculations and some, you know, things that I can do. To be honest, I was really looking for somebody like that, like this guy, to help me with all the calculations I was doing. Because as you can imagine, those guys can do the calculations I do in 2 days. He can do just in 10 minutes. So I knew
what type of calculation, Vasi, did you need help with?
Yes, I'm going to do what is the right lineup for a lead loud train for Mark, where he sits most economically, behind which guy he can spend the least amount of kilojoules, so he can be relatively fresh and really ready to do a sprint, and what is the right order and the right pace that we have to do during a session, for example, train session. It means that I had to take the files from every single rider, put it next to each other, and then find a way to make this one file, which was practically impossible for me to do that. While a guy like that, a data guy, can just take all the files and make a graph from those files on his own. I don't know how they do it. It's a code, they do, but I don't care. So
probably ChatGPT, Vasi.
I don't think it's possible with ChatGPT.
No, now. I don't think so. I don't think so.
Anyways, so yeah. I met with this guy with the call, and I said, okay, I find really interesting what you're telling me now, but I cannot go back to the team to Vinokuro and say, we had to hire a data analyst, because probably you're going to tell me, what is this? So I'm going to hire you. I'm going to pay you out of my pocket. And I want to work together only for the Project 35. And of course, during the season, I saw that he was really helpful to many areas that I could. I had everything in my mind, but I didn't know how to translate it into words, into numbers. So he helped me a lot. And then when Mark won, he just showed up to the hotel. And I said to Vinokuro, we have to sign this guy because he will be really useful. Full stop. Don't ask any questions. I just really want to hire this guy. And Vino did it, of course. So back to August of 2024, I sat down with Morgan. And then I said, okay, this is the situation now. We have only, for the whole year, we have only 7,000 points. We need minimum 13,000 points not to be relegated. I want to go back and try to find, to make an analysis of the strengths and limits of the whole roster of the team, make a statistical analysis of where those riders have been performing, when during the season they have been performing best, in the early season, the middle of the season, later on. Quantify the races that we need to do in order to achieve the maximum amount of more points. Also, quantify based on a score which races on the same category are easier, let's say, to achieve points compared to some other races. For example, if you go to Vuelta Andalucía, which is two-point pro race, it's most probably that you will face Vingegaard, Evenepoel, Pogacar. But if you go to Tour of Hungary, for example, which is in the same category, but the starting list is much lower on quality, then you have more chances to win. I gave him almost 2 months. We're chatting, as you can understand, almost daily about all those things. And then at the end of December, we present the whole idea to the management. And the idea was just simple. We have to start winning as early as possible. First of all, because of the psychological boost that the team could have. And we had to target some lower category races and some specific races where we knew that our riders would perform. And this is what we did.
Vasi, you've talked about the race program, which is a key facet of why you were successful. And we'll come on to talk more about that in a minute. But you're also talking about a time of year, so August, when a lot of teams have already done their recruitment. And recruitment is also a big piece of this, I would imagine. I mean, you had, and this was not unusual for Astana, a lot of years, of the last few years, you've had sort of 15 riders come in, 15 riders leave, but there was a lot of recruitment that was done. So I'm looking at guys who ended up being key figures, guys like Sean Poussin, Malucelli, Ulisse even, Tournison. How much was Morgan's work, the data scientist's work, instrumental in the riders you eventually recruited?
No, The riders were already signed before August. So we had already been working with together with Maurizio Mazzoleni, the sports manager, and Vinokurov on recruiting those riders earlier on. So by the time we start working with Morgan about the, you know, the points and everything, we already had the core of the team. So I think everybody was signed by then.
But these were key, these riders, so Gate, for example, and maybe we'll talk more in detail about him later, but this was a rider, it was obvious that he had been recruited because he was someone who had shown that in the kind of race you're talking about, Hungary, but particularly races in the Far East, this was someone who could collect a lot of points.
Yes.
So someone in the organization, and maybe you can just talk to us a little bit about how the recruitment had happened and who really is in charge of recruitment. Was that you? Was that Vinokurov? Clearly, people were already thinking about, well, we need to recruit riders who might get us a lot of points.
Yeah, it was just those three of us. Me, Mazzoleni and Vinokurov.
Okay.
We're already talking about which riders we need already from June, July. Because as you can understand, the managers had the team managers have a lot of requests from the agents. So once there was a request, we're going through the power profile of the rider and the characteristics, and we can see if they fit in our program or not. For example, you're talking about Malucelli. Malucelli was a rider who spent his whole life in the Conti teams, but he was really successful in Asia. And with the Chinese sponsor coming to the team, we knew that we had to do some more races in Asia and we had to win this race in Asia. Whereas cycling there is a completely different thing to Europe. So we know that Malucelli had already won 9 races in Asia. We had an interview with him. I saw that we can help him develop more and improve his sprinting and everything more. So we signed him, and then last year had, again, 9 or 10 wins. Same goes to Gate. Gate was a rider who was focused on the track earlier on, but I knew that he would be exceptional for this kind of race and also for the semi-classics, for the lead outs. So I was already pushing Vino since June, I remember, for Gate. And Gate was already Mark's suggestion. So Mark really wanted to have Gate on the team already the year before. So then we have Higuita, Ulissi. We knew that they were riders who can perform really well on one-day races. And they can bring a lot of points. So the recruitment was based on the characteristics of the riders and the races that we already thought that we were going to do next season. For example, we had Wout Poels, who could be was a rider that didn't win races, but we knew that he could be really helpful for the other guys or for his own opportunities if we sent him to an easier race, as he did with Tour of Turkey, for example. So every single one of them was already selected before November, before August. So by August, we had the roster, and then we start working on their ideal, let's say, race program.
Vasi, I'm just thinking about some of the guys you did recruit, like Mike Turnison, for example. And we'll talk later about the number of race days some of these guys did. A lot of them did well over 70 race days, some of them over 80. Conchi was another one who did a huge number of races. How much did you emphasize in your conversations with these riders that they would be racing a lot and the main goal for them would be to accumulate points? Was this a big part of the conversation with these riders?
I think that exactly point was the key of the success of the team. So in late October, the whole team met in Italy for the pre-season meeting, as all the teams do. We had already prepared a draft plan for each one of these riders. And we're really clear there. We just told them, you know, guys, this is a special season. If we don't succeed, we're going to fail and probably we're going to lose the sponsor. Maybe the team doesn't continue. Who knows? So we have to do everything to get as many points as possible. And this is our idea. So we want everybody to agree on that. Because as you can understand, if they didn't agree, then it would be a failure. So everybody already since November knew that they had to follow a specific strategy to accumulate as many points as possible or to help their teammates accumulate as many points as possible. And they knew that they had to train to race a lot. So they didn't have the standard year. And that was agreed by everyone. Everybody knew what they were going to do already from November, not even December. only from November on.
Because Vasi, you know how it works in most teams. And the impression that I get about most teams having spoken to riders is that traditionally, maybe in the camp that you talk about, sort of the end of season camp, so teams will sometimes, you know, they have 3 days after Tour of Lombardy where they get together and talk, or if not, the December camp where the rider goes in and he meets all of the directeurs sportifs and he gives a vague sort of outline of the races he sees himself doing, and there's a sort of discussion, and from that, the race program is made. It sounds almost as though Morgan had done his analysis, he'd come back with a plan, and you almost then were in a position to present all of the riders, or most of the riders, with their race program already, based on his analysis. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, so of course, Morgan couldn't make the right calendar for everybody. What Morgan did though, he just quantified the races from the highest scoring number, so from the most difficult one to the easiest one. Let's say we have the 2.1 races. Which one is the most difficult to get points and which the easiest? And then he just presented us the yearly plan. And then when each one of these riders is performing best and under which conditions. I'm going to give you an example. The three best riders of this season, so not the best, the riders who accumulated the most points are the riders who were already in the team last year. Scaroni was the best rider, the rider with the highest amount of points. He was also last year in the team. But the mistake we did last year was, for example, sending him to do races when the climate is very warm, like Australia. From the analysis Morgan did, we saw, and also with the conversation we had with him, we saw that Scaroni is performing really well when the weather is not so good. So at the beginning of the season and at the end of the season. So based on that, we had, for example, the last 3 years calendar, and we could see where these riders were performing. So based on all this info, then I start together with Maurizio Mazzoleni, putting the piece of the puzzle together and making the right plan for everyone. Of course, the plan that we present in November was not 100% accurate. We had to wait for the Vuelta Rutana presentation, the Giro presentation. We didn't know the route sketch. But I can say now that it was almost 90-95% exact. Accurate, and then in December we just fine-tune this plan. And I have to admit that Astana was the team with the highest racing days of the whole peloton this year. We had 320 yes racing days, and UAE was the second team with
296. Yes, I've got it in front,
and that was a huge increase in the racing days and a huge risk from our side, because if we had riders who got sick or injured, then the whole plan would collapse, because we didn't have the riders to do that. And that's why the help from the Devo team was really, really crucial. And this is something that we communicate with the guys at the Devo team and the riders from the Devo team already in December on, that they should play a really crucial role in the World Tour team success. I can give you an example. We did Tour of Hellas, of my home country, and we won this race with Lopez. But we had 4 out of 6 riders come from the Devo team, because it was simply that we didn't have enough riders to do the race. We knew that Ulisse and Lopez could do something really good on GC, and Sirica could do something in the sprints. So Sirica was every day at the sprints top three. He was making top three. And then Lopez finished first and Ulisse fourth on the GC, which gave us a lot of points. But without the Devo team, it would be impossible to do things like that.
Right, Vasi. And well, you as head of performance as well, I guess you had to think about how the riders were going to be resilient and how they were going to stay healthy and how they were going to be able to, well, cope with these big seasons as well. I mean, I know there was some work done on nutrition as well, but what were some of the other, well, you can talk about the nutrition maybe, that there were changes made, I think, but some of the other kind of things that were put in place to make sure that the riders were also going to be resilient.
Yeah. So we had a really close cooperation with our head nutritionist, with Luca Simoni and our doctors, because that was the most important thing, to keep the riders healthy. So once we made the race program, we set up the dates of the altitude camps, the sea level camps, the resting periods. We just tried to make sure that we had the periods of overload for the riders, some good periods of recovery, and then again. And we had the backup from the doctors and the nutritionists that they are, you know, they are doing their thing to keep the riders healthy, which means that they were doing blood tests regularly to see if they are missing something or if they need to take some extra supplements or anything. We did some tests with the University of Padova to test the stomach correlation. So in reality, to put it simple, how many grams per hour each one of them can tolerate, because we have some riders who can take 90 grams per hour, and some other riders can take 160 grams per hour, for example. So we had to find out what are the limits of each rider and how we can improve those limits. So this is a work that I started already from December, from the camp in December on, and just continued through the whole year long.
But this was new?
Yes, yes, yes. That was something new, yes.
And I'm wondering as well, in the recruitment as well, was this something that you had thought about, that you needed guys, you needed your point scorers to be guys who could also score points over a lot of days? Because, you know, if I look, Vasi, and we'll look in more detail in a minute about where you actually scored the points, but it wasn't a case of going to races. You didn't have people who scored 300 points at races. It was a lot of small results, basically. And you were able to do that, as you said, because of the number of race days, and you were scoring points on a daily basis. But it wasn't necessarily a huge number of points. But you needed people who were going to be healthy over sort of 70, 80 days. Did you look for that in the recruitment as well?
Yes, yes. So also our strategy was to try to have as many riders as possible in the top 10. Some races, which meant that we could, at the beginning, especially at the beginning of the season, we could sacrifice winning the race, the scoring more points by adding two or three riders in the top 10. It's a funny story, because one of my ex-colleagues, yes, from Quickstep, David Bramati, called me after the second race in Spain, and he told me, "Oh, Vasi, what are you doing there? Instead of trying to win the race, you have fourth, fifth, and sixth rider in the top 10. So what's this?" And I told him, "You know, if I win this race, it's 1.5 points. But if I have fourth, fifth, and sixth, it's 140 points. So what's best? I have to play by the rules. These are the rules now. This is what we have to do to survive. And that's why we're playing like this." So every week, we had weekly meetings. Every Tuesday morning, we had weekly meetings. And I was making the analysis of the riders, the performance of the riders. And Morgan was setting the benchmarks. And we're saying, okay, now we're ahead of schedule or behind schedule. Or we have to do to change the strategy and try to go for the win or try to go for the top three. Of course, this is not Pro Cycling Manager. We're talking about races and you know, human performances. So, luckily, the plan was working. I'm going to give you an example. During the Giro, in late April, we accumulated 1,000 points in 1 week by winning Tour of Hungary, Tour of Turkey, Velasco finishing fourth in Liège-Bastogne-Liège. We had another success in Fortunato finishing, winning a stage and finished fourth again in Romandie. While winning the Giro Italia would just give us 1,100 points. So you can imagine, in 1 week, we gathered almost more points than winning Giro Italia just because of this planning. Mm-hmm. Of course, we had riders who got sick, got injured, but we're lucky enough that we didn't have so many periods of this bad luck. It could have been completely different. For example, if we had a massive crash in Amstel, where we lost four riders, and then we're really scared of, okay, what's going to happen from now on if we don't have those riders back early? But I think the whole programming was based on those periods, on the periods of recovery that the riders could have. So they were just changing the teams all the time. Also, as I said, with the addition of the leveler, of the devil riders in the lineups.
Mm. You had a very fast start, Vassin. You just talked about the race in Spain, where already we could see that strategy of looking for points, farming points in maybe easier races to score. This meant obviously the riders had to come into the season in very good condition and sort of ready to fire. Now, having spoken to, for example, Mark Cavendish about the way camps, training camps at Astana used to be, you know, he talked about how there was a bit of a culture in Astana, maybe predating when you arrived, of everyone sort of riding pretty easy at camps and then everyone kind of racing up climbs. And he felt it was less structured than it had been other teams that he was in. I imagine that the way you structured the camps and the kind of training that the riders had to do in the closed season before 2025 was very much targeted towards scoring a lot of points early. Would you confirm that, that a lot of the training the riders did last winter was very deliberately focused on them starting fast?
No. It was just more structured, the training. So there was no just attacking every single climb here and then without any plan or... So already from 2023 on, when I joined the team, I just changed the way that the training was performing, and together with the other coaches, I just set the, you know, my rules, I can say. So every single session was pointed in one component of fitness. So today we have to work on road to max. Then we have to do lead out trains. Then we have to do sprints for the sprint. So, you know, whatever. So it was just really more structured. On 2024, the team, that the group that was already planned to start racing early on, you know, on January, of course, they did some more high intensity trainings, training sessions. Mm-hmm. So, in that sense, The training was focused on them being in a really good form already in end of January, February. And then we tried to find the way to keep those riders fresh. But most of those riders, they just went full guard till March. And then they had a break. And then they had to go again. Then we had another group of riders going. So the group of riders who scored the points in all those races in Mallorca. So we started with Spain, Mallorca, and then some races in France. They just kept going like this till Strade Bianche, which is early March, and then had a break. Then had the classic guys who went up to altitude and start doing really well during the whole classic season, but their training was completely different. So imagine that in December and January, we had heading out with four different groups every day, because every single group had to do their specific work.
And I remember speaking to you in maybe April or May and sort of complimenting you on how well the team had done already, but you were anxious at that point still. I mean, obviously the team wasn't safe yet, but I remember you also saying that you felt that the first few months of the year were good for the team, were good for the plan you had, and that it might then get more difficult. It didn't really prove to be the case. Sort of in May, June, July, August was still pretty fertile for you.
Yes, I was really anxious because I didn't know what would happen. As I said, if we had a big crash and we lose 5-6 riders, if we had some COVID cases, and then we couldn't perform well, what would happen? For example, we went to the Tour de France, not with a GC rider, but with the aim of scoring top 10s and trying to win a stage. Okay, we didn't win. Ballerini finished second the last stage in Champs-Élysées, but we had a lot of points, for example, for Tour de France. And from the analysis we did at the end of the season, half of the points came back from the World Tour races, not from the 0.1 races or 2.1 races. So everybody thinks that we score points in the small, in the lower category races. Yes, we did. But we shouldn't forget that we get a lot of points from Giro d'Italia, from Vuelta, from Tour de France, from the classics. I think this year was the best year since 2018 or something for the classics for the team.
Yeah.
The team Astana, I think they never had the top 10s in all the classic, the cobbled classics in, Place Vallon, Ronde, Paris-Roubaix, in all those races. My intention was to do a really good start, basically for psychological reasons. You have another dynamic. If you start winning early, you know, you keep just the flow.
Yeah.
You don't start well.
Well, I was about to ask you about this. I mean, this is another factor. It must be how energized the riders were by this whole project. And I remember speaking to, I think it was at Paris-Nice, speaking to Mike Turnerson about this, about, you know, most of the riders will not have ridden in this way, raced in this way for their whole career. And, you know, you often have the impression, particularly in the age of Pogacar, Vingegaard, Van der Poel, you often have the impression that teams go to races with, okay, a hopeful goal of we want to get in the breakaway today, or we'd like to win the stage today. But realistically, a lot of the time they feel as though they're just riding round. And it was very obvious that you were a team this year that had a goal every day. Now, how energizing was that for the riders and also for the staff? And when did you really start to realize that there was a sort of magic in this energy that it was giving the riders?
Already in December at the camp. So I had a meeting with everybody, with the whole, with the staff, with the riders. And then we just told them, you know, guys, now it looks that we need a miracle to survive, to get the points. But remember that we did the miracle last year with Mark winning the 35th, achieving the 35th victory. Because if I ask you all, who would believe before that Mark should achieve this victory? I think I'm going to have one or two positive answers. So we're in the same situation now. If I ask you now who believes that we're going to succeed, maybe I'm going to have none answer. So the motivation and the will for to do something extra start already from there. And then, of course, when the riders start winning in January and February, everybody was just really happy and was willing to give 110%. Also the guys who joined the team, you know, like Peter Kinnock, like Alex Dowsett, together with Morgan, those guys brought something new, really fresh. There was something really new to the team, a new motivation, a new aura, as I could say, together with Mark Renshaw, who unfortunately left now for Decathlon. So there was a new group, new faces, people who just drag also the other guys. Lapage, the Belgian guy who came from the territory to Astana after some years. So it was just, the whole thing was new. The whole, it was a new project, I can say, with new faces, with new dynamics. And this just kept going through the whole year long.
Mm. Another thing that was new, Vasi, was the bikes. Now, obviously, they bought in XDS. That deal was kind of done in 2024, I think. And obviously, they brought some investment as well, which was important. But I guess a lot of people were skeptical about the bikes. They didn't know how good these bikes were going to be. And I think you mentioned Alex Dowsett. I think he was kind of reassured when you did a test, I think, at the training camp, and a lot of the guys had their best sort of 5-minute power, which sort of reflected the fact that the bikes were, you know, certainly stiff enough. Was that an area in which there were improvements made as well in terms of equipment?
Of course, everybody was skeptical. I was really skeptical when XDS joined because we didn't know anything about those bikes. But when we gave those bikes to the sprinters and they started doing some sprints, they immediately said, wow, this is just a good bike. So I can we can see also, as you said, on the power meters, they're scoring immediately 10 seconds best sprint. At the beginning, I thought that something was wrong with the power meters, for example. And then with the collaboration of the factory, so the privilege we have is that they design and they build the bikes on their own factory. Those guys build the bikes in-house. So had a guy who's constantly in China, Servais, was the owner and the founder of Argon Bikes. He's working now. He's the middleman between the team and the factory. We have also Dimitri Sedun and especially Alex Dowsett, who keeps giving feedback to the factory, because we did a lot of testing last year on the colds, on the wind tunnel and everything. So the feedback that we give back, is immediately translated into a new project. So for example, the bike was a little bit heavy at the beginning. We said the bike is rigid, but we should make it lighter. Bam, after three months, we had a lighter version of the bike. Or we need the bike to work better with this kind of wheels that we use. So all those things just played a huge role in the rider's performance.
Yeah.
And we're lucky enough now to have, according to me, one of the fastest bikes in the market. Even though XTS is known to the European, even to America, nobody knows XTS. Why? They have, I think, the biggest factory in China, and they even produce six other brands in their factory.
Right.
Brands that still race through the France, I mean. So they have the knowledge, they have the know-how. It was just a matter of time for them to produce their own bike.
Mm.
So based on the knowledge they have gathered all these years from the brands that they work for.
Okay. Vasya, in a minute, I'm going to ask you just what you've sort of learned from this process. But there was one other thing that I wanted to also ask you about. We talked about the race programs and what was it, 300 and something days, 320 days of racing that the team had to do. I was wondering about the sort of costs, the kind of hidden costs of this as well, because logistically, there are considerations. I mean, you have to get staff to various parts of the world. Obviously, race organization is supposed to cover some of the costs, but they won't have covered all of the costs. How much of an effort did it take, just sort of logistically, practically, in terms of manpower and also financially, to do that amount of racing?
Yeah, we're really fortunate that XDS stepped up last year and they increased the budget. I don't know exactly numbers, but were they okay from Vinokurov to do as many camps, as many races, whatever basically we needed, because we had the backup from XDS, and if needed, we still had some money to get from Astana. So that was never my consideration. I just want to make the best plan. Of course, we recruit some new mechanics, some extra soigneurs for the races, for the extra racing days. But we just had the green light to go for it. So we didn't care, to be honest, about the cost.
Okay. And Vasya, at what point, maybe there was a precise moment, at what point did you feel as though the job was done, the miracle was complete, and did you celebrate it immediately?
I think I never celebrated during the season. I was happy during the Tour de France because I was constantly asking Morgan the time that we had mathematically mathematically secured our 18th position. And that didn't came until September, I think. Because I just want to be 100% sure, 1000% sure that whatever happens, for example, if Cofidis start winning now all the races till the end of the season, I want to be sure that even if this happens and I get no points, I will still be in the World Tour. So that came later on. I think by beginning of September, we're just really secure that we're there.
And I said I was going to ask you what you've learned. I mean, Vasi, well, Morgan probably has learned even more about the UCI rankings system, but you've obviously had kind of intimate experience of it this year. There are a lot of criticisms of this system, and there are races. I mean, it's impossible to come up with a perfect system. But there have been a lot of criticisms about certain races, types of races being overvalued, others being undervalued. One thing that's been pointed out by a lot of people is that, for example, Grand Tours in general classification might be undervalued, considering, I mean, if we were to compare how the UCI ranking system rates a fifth place in a Grand Tour with, for example, market value. I mean, this is something that our mutual acquaintance Mark Cavendish gets very upset about, that he thinks that sort of guys who finish fifth in the Tour de France are overrated in terms of market value. You know, they can command salaries of sort of 3 million euros a year, but that's certainly not reflected by the rankings points. The rankings points seem to maybe over-index classics one-day races. But what are your sort of big conclusions about this ranking system and how well it works and what could maybe be changed?
To be honest with you, I almost never... I never considered of the ranking system till this year. So when I was with Quickstep, we never care about if we get 200 points from this race or 100 points from that race. I start considering it already, as I told you last year, after the Tour de France. By coincidence, winning a stage to the Tour de France is giving you, I think, less points than winning a one pro race, which is really unfair. On the other hand, also the smaller races need to survive. So what do you do? Do you just take out all the points from point one races and pro races? Then they will disappear.
No.
So everybody's right on this. But also UCI needs to respect and to defend the rights of those smaller races. Otherwise, those races will disappear and then we'll have only Tour de France, Giro and Vuelta, and that's it.
Yeah.
Is it fair for the sport? No, it's not fair for the sport. So I also don't agree with the point system as it stands right now, but honestly, I don't have a solution. No. I don't think there's a solution that will satisfy everybody.
Mm.
We just have to play by the rules every time. These are the rules right now. We have to adapt. And the sooner we realize that we need to do something, the better it will be. This is the example of Astana. Probably we did our homework while some other teams didn't during the winter.
Yeah, that's why, you know. Just sort of reading interviews, Vasi, and I'm going to speak to someone from Cofidis and we'll learn more about that in due course, but just looking at sort of interviews people from Cofidis gave, it was pretty evident that the way they were thinking about the season was a lot more traditional than the approach that you took. And they were still talking about scoring heavily in the major tours, where that was probably the worst place to look for points in some respects. And in fact, they performed very poorly at the major tours, particularly at the Tour de France. They got almost nothing in terms of points. And their strategy might not have been the most wise in that respect.
Yes, but if I wasn't there, sure, I would probably do the same. We started the season with a 5,000 points deficit to Cofidis, while the previous season we had scored 7,000 points for the whole season long. So if I wasn't Cofidis, probably I would be also a little bit secure that my place is okay. Astana is not going to make it, because we're talking about a team who had 6,000 points 2023. 7,000 points, 24, and then they went from 7,000 points to 13,000 points. No, 13 or 16? I don't think
16,
you remember. But
16.
16, yeah. 13 was our target. Yes, 13 was our target, our projection, and then we did 16, which is just unbelievable. So I cannot blame Cofidis. Probably once they saw that Astana started winning a lot of points at the first 2-3 months, they should have the flexibility to change their strategy and their race program. What we saw is that, of course, they will explain you later on their strategy, but we saw that they start doing a lot of races with the same riders, which has led to just, you know, riders getting injured or sick or getting tired. And at the end, it was just a boomerang effect. They didn't score any points at the rate that they're entering.
So I suppose the last question I've got, Vasi, is just in terms of this relegation promotion system. I mean, I think that it's been fascinating. It's fascinating to hear you talk about it. And this is something kind of new to learn about and to hear about, and some of the detail that you've gone into. I think it's another sort of, we always talk about narratives and how can we make cycling more interesting, exciting. Well, I think this is a great one to sort of grab people's attention. But the problem is that, well, you said you'd never thought about UCI points until this year. And I suppose that is the problem of the system, that we as spectators, media, whatever, we're only going to be interested in this for sort of 6 months, the last 6 months of a 3-year cycle. Now, we talked about you joining Astana and the first year being very much about Mark Cavendish and Project 35. And this, the hunt for points, has been very much the identity of the team and also the kind of raison d'etre of your job this year. Now, what what kind of conversations are you going to have about points for 2026, the first year in the cycle? Because this can't become the team's identity, can it? Although it's been a great identity for the team in 2025, it can't be for 2026.
We already had this conversation. We have already the plan for 26. The idea is that we just continue as we did with 2025. We identify, now what is the optimal racing days. Of course, we're not going to do 320 days again. So we already did our homework. We know how many racing days we're going to do and what is the target of the season. The target comes always from the sponsors and from the general manager. So we just have to execute the target set by the general manager. What I can say is that we need to just keep going, keep the same momentum. Of course, we're not going to risk as we did in 2025. As I said, doing too many races and racing, 320 days. But we're going to target specific days and specific races where we need to win. So we just need to keep the momentum from 25 to 26. That's the whole idea of the team. Because we start the new circle, the new three-year circle, but in order to be secure, this year we finish fourth on the ranking. So next year we also target to finish among the first 10 teams. So we can, can target easily without stress, specific races and stages at the Grand Tours and everything.
Okay. Well, and finally then, how enjoyable has it been? I mean, you've had two incredible personal years now professionally with Mark Cavendish, Project 35. And that was a miracle in a lot of people's eyes that you pulled off. And then you've had another one this year. I mean, how enjoyable was this year?
Both years were really stressful, as you can understand.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But, the satisfaction you get once you have a mission accomplished, it's just huge. So this is the beauty of this job. When you're a trainer, you spend so many hours about questioning yourself, questioning about the preparation of the rider, and questioning if what you are doing is going to pay off, is going to be paid off. And once there's a victory, once there's the target, achieved target, then it's a huge, huge relief. It's a unique feeling. So I was really fortunate the last 2 years to set some really high targets, as you already said, to chase the miracles, and those miracles came true. So I can consider myself one of the most lucky or happy guys in this world tour, in this world, the cycling world.
What's the next one? Beat Pogacar at the Tour de France?
That's impossible for now. I think we have to invent a new Pogacar to beat this Pogacar.
Perfect.
But we're really fortunate of living in this area, with Remco's, Pogacar, Vingegaard. We're really, really, really blessed of what those guys race. It's just something magical.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.